There are two cannabis industries in the United States. One is legal, the other is illegal. Together, both industries generate a huge amount of money. Today, we pause to ask, can the legal and illegal cannabis industries just get along?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Folks, back in the 1930s, the intoxicating cannabis plant, which was then called marijuana, and lots of other names, was valued at pennies per pound. When cannabis was made illegal in 1937, its value increased. Today, the intoxicating plant is valued at thousands of dollars per pound. With so much value, the intoxicating plant now supports two cannabis industries, a legal industry with reported sales of $52 billion last year, and an illegal industry with revenues estimated to be equal to or even greater than the legal industry. That these two industries exist in the same place in the same time makes for a very interesting conflict. By way of illustration, consider the legal cannabis industry in California's Monterey County, which prides itself as being the salad bowl of the world. Monterey County's recent crop report claims the legal cannabis farms of the Salinas Valley make, get this, $5.2 million per acre per year. By comparison, those farms growing leaf lettuce make roughly $12,800 per acre per year. Huge difference, huh? From these numbers, it is easy to see that one can generate a lot of revenue from a small parcel of land. And that is reason enough that there exists a robust illegal cannabis industry. But if the illegal industry thrives and produces more cannabis than the market demands, the legal cannabis industry will lose its income. And so that leads us to this conflict, and we ask, can the legal and illegal cannabis industries just get along? Well, here to help us find an answer, we have Morgan Fox, who is the Media Relations Director at the National Cannabis Industry Association. Morgan, welcome to the Food Chain Radio Show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I have a question, kind of start things off. And it's a question I've been pondering for a long time. If cannabis had not been prohibited in 1937, do you think it would still be a $100 billion a year industry today?
Well, I think that's difficult to tell because you have to take into account inflation and a number of other things. But I think that it's important to recognize that cannabis was part of the United States pharmacopoeia for 150, 200 years before it became illegal at the federal level. And if that had not taken place, I don't think that we would have seen all of the artificial price inflation that comes along with pretty much any prohibited or illegal product. And you will also, on the other hand, would have seen a lot more research going on in the ensuing decades to the point where we would have a lot more access to much more researched and much more heavily developed cannabinoid medicines. So it's entirely possible that the price and general markets for these would be valued at roughly the same if cannabis had never been made illegal, but they would certainly look significantly different. I think what we would definitely have seen was probably roughly $1 trillion in savings over those decades that we have wasted on punishing people for using this plant.
Well, that is a very good answer to a very complex question, and that for that I thank you. So the National Cannabis Association, wow, National Cannabis Industry Association. So you've been in business 10 years. It's hard to imagine that an industry association for cannabis has been in business that long. How long has cannabis actually been legal? It seems like less than that.
Well, in 1995, California became the first state to allow medical cannabis use. It's important to note that cannabis is still very illegal at the federal level, and that causes a number of problems that affect both the regulated state legal industry as well as the illicit market. So starting around 1995, there really was still no industry to speak of. You know, states started tolerating commercial businesses and dispensaries for medical patients. Really, I mean, in California and in some of the early adopter states, dispensaries and legal cultivation wasn't really spelled out and explicitly allowed under the law. And when states did start allowing these things, or at least turning a blind eye, you still saw a lot of federal enforcement. I mean, there were raids every day and on collectives and dispensaries for years. But at around 2009, the federal government started issuing decrees to the Department of Justice, basically saying that enforcing federal prohibition in states that had passed medical cannabis laws was not to be a priority for federal prosecutors. So that really sort of paved the way for a lot of entrepreneurs in legal state markets to start feeling that they had a little bit of a safe harbor to be able to start opening up and expanding. And that really kind of signaled the start of the state legal marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, it has expanded into, now we have 33 states with comprehensive medical cannabis laws, as well as a number of territories. We have 11 states in which cannabis is legal, as well as D.C., Guam, and the Northern Mariana Islands. And in all of those states, with the exception of D.C. and Vermont, there is a legal adult use market. But as I said, you know, and now I think that there's roughly, you know, tens of thousands of legal cannabis licenses, whether they be for adult use or medical, in all of those states. You know, the industry employs something like 250,000 people and climbing. And as you said, this is a multi-billion dollar industry in the legal market, but the unregulated market dwarfs that. Around the country and continues to exist even in places with regulated markets, largely because of a combination of federal prohibition, which does things like preventing cannabis companies from being able to deduct business expenses on their taxes and limiting access to banking services, as well as overtaxation and incredibly stringent regulatory structures at the state level that make it impossible for legal cannabis businesses to be able to compete price-wise for the consumer with the illicit market. That being said, consumers really like the idea of being able to buy a clean, tested, regulated product in a safe and reliable environment. But for a large segment of consumers, price is the bottom line. And until the restrictions that are caused by federal prohibition and overtaxation at the state level are lifted, there's going to continue to be a thriving illicit market.
So then as I read it, the situation is such that cannabis is legal, but it's not legal.
Yes, there's a conflict between state and federal law. According to the federal government, cannabis is a Schedule I substance, which under that definition has no accepted medical usage and high potential for abuse. Every scientist that has looked at this has said that this is an inappropriate classification for the substance, but the DEA and the National Institute of Drug Abuse and the FDA have really been dragging their feet and obstructing research that would allow us to learn more about this plant, allow us to develop it more, and also would inform us in terms of developing policy. There's also, you know, decades of misinformation and stigmatization associated with it, despite the fact that cannabis is objectively safer than alcohol, and we as a society and in terms of legality have been able to deal with that.
Now, is it legal for farmers in, say, Oregon to grow cannabis and sell it to, say, Idaho?
Absolutely not. For a couple of reasons specific to that example, but interstate commerce is strictly forbidden in the cannabis market. There are a number of groups working to change that and a number of laws both at the state and federal level that are hoping to address that and form interstate compacts. But until either one of those bills in Congress is passed or cannabis is removed from the Controlled Substances Act, it is still very illegal to transport cannabis across state lines, even between two legal states.
Okay.
Idaho is actually one of three states that does not even have a medical cannabis program.
Okay, so then we're looking at a political situation, as I see it, where the previous administration in Washington, D.C. said, you know, we're just not going to pay attention to this. And so the industry has kind of taken off on its own and existing within each state, however it exists within each state. But on a national level, the current administration does not appear to be as favorable as the previous one. Am I wrong?
It's a little bit more nuanced than that. So at the very beginning of the Trump administration, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, or then Attorney General Jeff Sessions, rescinded the Cole memo, which was a directive from the Department of Justice to its federal prosecutors to leave legal cannabis markets alone. Basically, it instructed them not to use any resources to target any individuals or businesses that were in compliance with state laws when it came to cannabis. And this went for medical and adult use programs. When that policy was rescinded, everybody in the cannabis space kind of freaked out, and rightfully so, because this industry had basically been allowed to flourish absent federal prosecution and targeting. However, what we saw was that federal prosecutors in legal and medical states had seen that going after these businesses and going after patients and going after individuals involved in this market was a complete waste of resources. And so even though the leash was taken off by Jeff Sessions to be able to go after these companies, there was no crackdown. All of these federal prosecutors decided that they were going to continue with the status quo. And you saw more or less the same thing when Attorney General Barr took over. Since that time, however, we have seen some interesting things coming from specifically the Department of Justice. I think the most recent one is that Attorney General Barr spent roughly 90% of the antitrust division's budget going after 11 singular cannabis companies for antitrust violations, despite the fact that all of the prosecutors and federal agents involved in those cases were telling DOJ leadership that this was a waste of time, that there was no violations of antitrust laws going on. So it seems as if it was pretty much motivated directly by Attorney General Barr.
What kind of antitrust violations would there be?
Well, there are a lot of mergers and acquisitions going on cannabis all the time, although that slowed down a little bit just before the pandemic hit and continued through that. And, that's always something to look out for when big companies and multi-state operators start, buying each other up and having big mergers. It's something that people are paying attention to, but the real crux of antitrust violations are that there are no options for how people are able to do business. And what is definitely clear to the people that were involved in this case at the mid and lower levels is that there's still plenty of access outside of those big operators. So there's really no reason or justification to be spending such significant federal resources to investigate these companies.
Well, good. So the situation as it stands now is very confusing to all but a few who figured it out. Now, is there any, I know that there are stock available in cannabis companies in Canada. Is there any available through in United States?
There are a few cannabis stocks available on the U.S. markets, yes.
Okay, good.
There are actually an ETF for cannabis businesses actually just launched earlier this week.
Okay. So, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today, we're tackling an interesting question. Can the legal and illegal cannabis industries just get along? In the words of Rodney King. With us today, we have Morgan Fox, who is the Media Relations Director of the National Cannabis Industry Association, and has some very good answers to our very confused questions. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, it is legal in some states, not in others. It is not legal at all in the United States of America. All that said, the cannabis industry has grown into a huge industry with some, what, $52 billion in sales last year, and much more than that in the illicit marketplace. My goodness, a huge industry on a plant that can be grown just about anywhere. So, and yet here we have a National Cannabis Industry Association that's formed representing the industry. Tell us a little bit about the association, Morgan.
Well, just a quick correction. That $52 billion figure that you cited is for the global legal market.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there are a number of countries in Latin America and the EU, and we're starting to find some in Asia, which typically has very, very draconian drug policies, that is slowly supplanting the global illicit market. In the United States, the legal cannabis market, I believe this year was, or last year, was valued at somewhere around $10 billion. The illicit market dwarfs that. The National Cannabis Industry Association exists primarily to create a favorable political, legislative, and regulatory and social environment for legal and regulated cannabis businesses to thrive. So what that means is ending federal prohibition, allowing access to banks, rectifying the federal overtaxation issue, and figuring out ways for the federal government to be able to provide guidance and uniform standards for state regulators in each of these markets. Another part of that is making sure that we can start to displace the illicit market completely. I mean, the idea here being that, obviously a regulated and quality control tested product that is being sold by legitimate taxpaying operators is going to be far beneficial to any sort of illicit market actors, regardless of any sort of involvement in organized crime. The problem with this, as I was mentioning earlier, is that it's very, very difficult to thrive and compete with the illicit market, which, I mean, is obviously a problem, but it's also very difficult to even get into the legal market because of the high barriers of entry.
Yeah, we're going to like to pick that up. I'd like to pick that up down the ways just a little bit, but taking you back to the association, who pays the way for an industry association like yours?
Well, like pretty much every other trade association, we are funded entirely by member dues. A lot of the advocacy organizations that really paved the way for the creation of a legal cannabis market and the existence of our organization were based almost entirely on, individual small value donors or wealthy philanthropists, very much like a lot of other nonprofits.
That would be kind of like the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, probably, that got most of its donations from individuals.
Exactly. Organizations like that, the Marijuana Policy Project, Drug Policy Alliance, Students for Sensible Drug Policy, Americans for Safe Access, all of these organizations have played an integral role in moving policy along and allowing for the creation of state legal cannabis markets, as well as keeping tens of thousands of people that out of jail who simply for choosing to use a substance that's safer than alcohol.
Well, now, you've got a pretty good handle on the legal industry, but how does one get a sense of what the size and scope of the illegal industry is? Because it's all underground. It's, one person buying some pot from cannabis from another person and nobody's reporting anything. So how does one get a handle on what the size and scope of that industry is?
It's incredibly difficult. I know that... obviously, there are huge problems with sources of direct information because people don't want to give that information up. A lot of it is based on combinations between national surveys on reported consumption rates mixed with seizure rates around the country for illicit shipments and things like that. There are a number of factors that go into play in figuring out an estimate for the size of the illicit market, but it's not incredibly accurate. I think that there's definitely a lot of leeway there, which is another reason why the regulated market is so much preferable. You can actually track the money, and you can track a lot more data than that and be able to use that information to help define policies going forward that are beneficial to society, these businesses, and consumers.
Well, your association put together what you called a summit, and in which you addressed a lot of the issues involved in justifying the legal and illegal industries and the information you imparted to the general public, one of which was me, was most interesting. I was wondering if you would mind going through some of those takeaways from that summit, because I think it really illustrates the fix that we are in with respect to the industry. And I'll just go through them if I might. The first one you list was the industry has to find alternatives to arresting and incarcerating people.
Absolutely. I mean, we spent decades trying to stop people from getting arrested for cannabis, and we don't want to just turn around and start using law enforcement as a cudgel to eliminate the illicit market. Obviously, ethical and moral reasons, but also because it just simply doesn't work. We've seen for, the entirety of prohibition that you can't solve this problem through strict law enforcement and arrest our way out of it. There are a number of other methods at our disposal. Some of the ones that were discussed were specifically targeting properties that were being used to cultivate cannabis illegally, whether that be indoor or outdoor, as opposed to going in and just arresting everybody.
Putting a lien on somebody's property or something like that, or just confiscating the property, or what does that mean?
Even as simple as just like putting deadbolts on or putting padlocks on the doors, things like that. I mean, obviously it's a game of whack-a-mole, but a much better solution is to lower the barriers of entry into the legal market such that it incentivizes illicit actors to move into that market, because nobody wants to deal with the threat of arrest, but sometimes the financial incentives are significant. And the financial disincentives of becoming a regulated operator in many cases can be overwhelming and insurmountable. We're talking about arbitrary license caps that only allow a certain number of licenses in a given area, and which generally favor much more well-funded individuals and groups. Right. We're talking about application and licensing fees, which can be hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're talking about meeting incredibly onerous regulatory requirements in a number of different fields. And then we're talking about incredibly high state and local taxes, and then the inability to deduct business expenses on your federal taxes, which results sometimes in a 70% effective tax rate just for federal taxes, not even counting everything else. Plus the fact that you're very limited in the markets that you're allowed to participate in, and you're limited within state lines.
Right.
So these barriers of entry are automatically baked in and discourage a lot of people from getting involved. But then you have to compound the historical aspects of it. All right, cannabis prohibition has specifically targeted economically and racially marginalized communities, and so these communities have often turned to illicit cannabis sales as simply a way to make ends meet, because a lot of other job opportunities and economic opportunities are unavailable to them, and these communities traditionally have had the ability to generate generational wealth stripped from them because of frequent arrests and over-incarceration and over-policing. So when you combine all of those factors together, and you have lack of access to capital, no access to traditional lending because of federal banking restrictions, right, the inability to really depend on deep financial networks or angel investors because of a general lack of access in those communities, that makes those barriers of entry even more insurmountable.
Let me back up a little bit and suggest that it seems to me that the role of law enforcement over the past, I don't know, half century with respect to cannabis has been to keep the price up by arresting an occasional farmer or dealer or what have you. And because the farmer is arrested, it keeps the supply down and it keeps the price up because it makes it much more difficult to produce. Am I wrong there? So, if you stop arresting the farmers and throwing him in jail, and just say it's, well, ollie oxen free, won't everybody grow pot? And that would really destroy the value for the legal industry as well.
Well, so it's a little bit more complicated than that. The vast majority of cannabis arrests are consumers and street-level distributors. So that doesn't really affect price too much in terms of supply. We've seen the supply-side efforts to eliminate or to eliminate drugs and to raise their prices to the point where it discourages consumers has not worked for any substance. The only thing it does is makes it a much more valuable and lucrative commodity, and the people that are on the supply side end up making the kind of money that allows them to put together transnational drug organizations. And we've seen the social and criminal costs of that around the world, particularly in Mexico. So if you're arresting farmers, you know, that really doesn't affect the overall supply too much, and it doesn't affect the price all that much. The only thing that really affects price is the cost of doing business in terms of perceived threat of arrest when it comes to at the distribution end of it.
The more dangerous, so, I mean, the more dangerous it is to produce, the more valuable it is on the street.
And it's really not about production because you know, as soon as you have you pinch one little area of production, there are so many more just waiting to take their place. Yeah. And you know, the illicit market operates on the principle of a certain percentage of acceptable losses when it comes to either production or shipment.
Okay, the other aspect of your answer to the first point here about alternatives to arresting and incarceration was making it easier for people to get in the legal business. Now, if you do make it easier to get into the legal business, wouldn't that also increase the supply and thereby reduce the value of the cannabis and making it less attractive to be in the business?
Well, that actually has happened in a couple of places, particularly in Oregon, where because of oversupply and the inability to sell their products outside of Oregon, the price per pound of cannabis for the adult wholesale market dropped from, I think it was around $1,200 per pound to $150 per pound. And, you know, we saw a lot of problems with this, and a lot of people went out of business. This can be easily solved by opening up interstate commerce, because there are some places that are just environmentally and climatically better for growing cannabis. And being able to have these states that exist within these climate zones and have this really deep history of cannabis cultivation and a lot of knowledge and experience are able to be the sort of breadbasket for the cannabis market and be able to sell their wares in other states that don't have the same sort of agricultural conditions.
Well, that leads us to the second point in the summit takeaways, which was how to better define the illicit market. Because as you said, in Oregon, everybody was free. Go ahead, grow all the pot you want. And people did, and all of a sudden, it was everywhere. What do you do with it? Well, you sell it to Idaho, the next door neighbor, but you can't because that's illegal. So there are, you know, all kinds of different legalities involved here. And one of the takeaways of your summit was to justify all those illegalities. How would you go about doing that?
Well, I mean, none of these illegalities really are justifiable. I mean, these are failed policies that have only caused harm, far more than any harms caused by cannabis itself. Yeah, I mean, it's really an unjustifiable policy position that we're in right now, and that's what we're working to change. There is absolutely no reason that cannabis should be illegal and that people shouldn't be able to engage in interstate commerce or do any of the other things that any other agricultural commodity industry can do. Obviously, though, we want regulations as well, which I know sounds kind of funny coming from an industry association, but we've seen that there is a need for regulatory structures, particularly when it comes to product safety. You know, generally, when it comes to flower cannabis, obviously, you know, it's very rare for there to be any sort of, large scale health problems associated with it. Otherwise, we would have seen it epidemiologically over the course of decades. But there are things now that are potentially very problematic. We saw that with the vaping crisis that occurred starting last fall. And what we found was that, and a study actually just came out very recently, kind of pinpointing this, that in places that did not have regulated legal cannabis markets, the illicit market, which was entirely unregulated, these operators were able to more easily dilute the products that they were making with adulterants such as vitamin E, acetate, and other other products that were, it turned out, incredibly dangerous for consumers. And so we saw that the vast amount of the cases reported of this illness called E-Valley were located in places with no access to legal, tested, regulated cannabis products.
So there you go. Well, another problem of the that the summit sought to find a way of managing is the root cause of the illicit market, which, boy, why is it illegal in the first place? And how do we get access? How do we open up access? And, well, we're going to pick that up when we come back from this break. But this is a very, very interesting problem faced by the industry of cannabis. As represented by the Cannabis Industry Association, and our guest today who's joining us to fill us in on how all of this works, Morgan Fox, who's the Media Relations Director for the National Cannabis Industry Association. And what we're looking at is a situation in which there are two industries, the baby legal industry that's just forming and trying to find a way to out into the sunshine from the darkness, and the dark industry, which is under the table. How are we going to justify the two of them? Right back after these messages.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
History buffs. This tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. This is an hour of what's eating what up and down the cannabis industry. We've been talking about how the National Cannabis Industry Association got together and put a summit together with law enforcement and industry groups and professionals, and looked at the industry and tried to figure out how to justify the legal industry with the illegal industry, and try to figure out how to make things work. And looked at some of the problems, and there's a lot of problems. And one of them Morgan Fox brought up earlier was the simple lack of opportunities in marginalized communities with respect to an alternative to getting involved in the drug trade. And one of the areas I've been following for quite a while is the Golden Triangle area of Northern California, which is a rural area. It has lots of trees, places to hide. And it was once a great timber industry, but that's gone. And it once had a big fishing industry, and that's gone too. So pretty much the only thing left was cannabis. And so for decades, that was the industry of Northern California. Now, you talk about part of the problem being is provide them something else. Morgan, what would that be that those folks in Northern California could do to replace the cannabis industry?
Well, I don't think that it's really an issue of replacing it. It's an issue of regulating it in a way that is not overly cumbersome and isn't stifling for businesses. What we saw when California made cannabis legal in 2016 is that around 2018, when all of the regulations were put into effect, a lot of businesses that had been existing under the medical cannabis laws for years and had been able to operate effectively were suddenly faced with a whole bunch of really unnecessary regulatory requirements that made it simply impossible for them to financially meet those requirements and stay in business.
Could you give us an example? Could you give us an example of some of those regulations and rules?
Just a real quick one is based on water usage, it basically requires a whole bunch of testing and additional restrictions on runoff that no other businesses really have to deal with, it can be extremely expensive. I think a real big issue, though, is taxation. And, right now, the California legislature just passed an emergency rule that would freeze any sort of increases in cannabis taxes for the next year while the legislature was able to look at a long-term tax structure that would actually work for the state and for these businesses. But what we saw was that a lot of these businesses that couldn't afford to meet the regulatory requirements to get a license under the new scheme just kept operating. But now they were operating illegally in a way that they weren't before. And so that's definitely an issue that needs to be addressed, because we have legacy operators, whether they be growers in the Emerald Triangle or whether they be street level distributors in Oakland. We need to find a way to make it easier to bring these people into the legal market so that they don't have to operate in the shadows, and so that their products and services are overseen and regulated, and the state as well as the industry has an ability to provide some oversight.
So it would make it a lot easier for everybody in the industry to not be legal, because then you don't have to comply with all of these government rules and regulations and taxes. Now, as I understand it,
but you still go to prison.
You still go to prison if you got caught, and that's where I wanted to go with my next question. I wonder about law enforcement, because law enforcement, by and large, especially in a place like Mendocino, Humboldt counties, and whatnot, Those people are people who live in the community and work in the community. And so if they see somebody who was a legal medical marijuana distributor and all of a sudden is no longer a medical marijuana distributor but is still growing pot, you're as a sheriff, you know that they're illegal, but they're your neighbor. And really, it's legal, so why am I busting this guy? Doesn't that put an interesting bind on the efforts of law enforcement to enforce these laws?
I mean, absolutely. And the internal, both political and cultural issues are different from town to town and county to county. But I think that it really does put law enforcement around the country in a very difficult position in that they are basically being forced to either do the job of state regulators that should be done with a clipboard instead of a SWAT team. And they're also having to arrest people for something that other people are doing legally. And this is a big problem when it comes to the people that have been most harmed by prohibition overall. You know, there's still people sitting in prison for behavior that is now legal in the place where they were originally arrested. So that's why it's very important that when we look at legalization at the national scale, as well as implementation at the state level, that we keep those people and those communities in mind and make sure that the opportunities that are created by legal markets are open to everybody.
Well, okay, let's talk about what it would take for those illicit people to become licit, to become part of the real world. First of all, you have to figure out some way to make it easier just to get in. And right now, it's not easy to get in. I mean, I think of the farms in Monterey County that are making $5.2 million per year growing pot that, you know, somebody up in Mendocino County could grow for much less money. So how do we get those people into the legal industry when it's so difficult to get in legally?
Well, there's actually a number of steps that can be taken to help this problem. I can lay them all up for you right now.
Please.
I mean, the first, obviously, is ending federal prohibition. This would deal with the federal taxation issue. It would increase access to banking, which is absolutely necessary. Increase access to traditional lending, and remove the threat of arrest.
Does ending prohibition mean ending prohibition, or does it mean regulating? I mean,
there's no way that the cannabis is going to become legal at the federal level without it taking on some sort of a regulatory structure. And NCIA actually proposed a set of recommendations for federal agencies to appropriately regulate these products. We're just trying to turn that into law at this point.
Okay. So then that's how you will be able to restrict supply then. And the number of people who will be able to participate in the industry. You have to do that, don't you? I mean, you can't let everybody grow pot.
Look, it's a much more complicated issue than what you're suggesting right now.
Okay.
So, all right. First, we end federal prohibition, and that does not make cannabis legal in every state. State law still has to change, but it stops discouraging states from opening up legal cannabis markets. So then, if we want to get more granular, the best ways to open to basically make the legal market more accessible to people who are currently illicit operators is first, you have to remove all license caps, which are completely arbitrary, and they put competition in the licensing process instead of in the market where it belongs.
And that's next, all of that licensing is local, isn't it? I mean, that's a...
There's state licensing, and then it has to generally have local approval. That's another problem that is sort of somewhat ancillary to this, is that there are a lot of localities that completely ban cannabis businesses, which encourages the illicit market as well as creating a slew of other issues. So once you've removed arbitrary license caps, then you have to start looking at costs. You have to lower the application fees so that they're reasonable for a regular person with a small amount of funding to be able to get these licenses so that they can put more of their capital into actually operating their businesses. You have to reduce state and local taxation on these products, because I think that a lot of politicians look at cannabis as basically a money tree. But there's only so much blood you can squeeze out of a stone before you overtax it to the point where it's impossible for legal operators to compete with the illicit market. Whereas if you drop those
And that's what's going on right now, right? Isn't that what's going on?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And so if you, in the long run, if you drop taxes, more sales take place in the legal market. And then long term, that generates more tax revenue for the state and for localities. And a lot of politicians really don't understand that. So that's an idea that we're trying to get across to them. And getting elected officials to lower taxes on anything is, you know, an uphill battle. But in this case, there is a very specific social and economic argument for it. Then you have to really do a lot of stuff that is not really necessarily related to policy, but really more related to investment culture. You know, we have to convince dispensaries to carry more products started by smaller businesses. You have to, you know, make it the general operating costs a little bit cheaper. You have to convince angel investors and other sources of capital to actually invest in these smaller businesses that may be coming out of the legacy market.
What do you mean by the legacy market?
People who have been involved in cannabis cultivation or distribution illegally.
Okay.
And that may continue to exist in like a state with a legal marketplace.
So doesn't that kind of put society at a fix as well, too? Because if you reward people who have been breaking the law with access to the legal market, does not that discourage people from obeying the law?
Well, considering that the laws were unjust and insensible in the first place, I don't really think that it's that's necessarily a problem. The fact is that, you know, like the whole carrot and stick argument here is just kind of moot. We need to work on solutions and not worry about punishing people for perceived slights and violations of, you know, failed and insensible laws.
Okay, that's fair enough. And then, so we have the problem of not speaking with one voice, which is something that your summit addressed. What does that mean?
I think that that was kind of referring to the fact that right now at both the federal and state level, there are a lot of different organizations, many of them pushing for the same thing, some of them with different focuses. And that can create somewhat of a muddled message when you're talking to lawmakers and other elected officials.
Okay, fair
enough.
That's
a little bit more inside baseball.
Okay, so can't we just get along? Something like that. Well, you know, I've been looking at this industry for quite a while. And as a matter of fact, way back in 1980, I visited 26 cannabis gardens for NBC Network Television throughout the growing season, and kind of have been following the industry ever since. And what I saw in visiting those 26 gardens was that every one of them got away with what they were doing. And nobody was arrested by the police, though we did visit some gardens within the company of police to watch the bust and make that part of the story. But most everybody got away with it. And most everybody was kind of making a living or a side living doing what they were doing. And it doesn't seem like things have really changed all that much. And we have this conflict, this essential conflict that I see in looking at the greenhouses in the Monterey County area that are making $5.2 million per acre. And people see that and like, my gosh, that's a huge incentive. And yet you have a crop that with industrial technologies could be grown for a few dollars per acre. So somehow there has to be some way of justifying those two numbers. Something that could be grown for a couple bucks per acre is selling for $5.2 million per acre. So is that not the crux of your association's efforts to justify this world?
No. I think that what you're seeing there is a little bit of an illusion. All right. So
okay,
people
good.
See all this money. People see all this money coming into the cannabis industry and all these monies in sales. But what they don't look at is how much it costs to run these businesses and how much it costs for them to be legal and compliant. Most cannabis businesses are making a razor thin margin, if not operating in the red all the time. All right. This is not some huge bonanza. And I think that that's what a lot of, regulators, the general public, as well as investors see when they look at this. They see all these dollar signs. They see all this income coming in. But what they're not looking at is what people are paying out. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to decrease those, or at least one of the things that we're trying to do is decrease those burdens so that these businesses, they might see prices drop, but their operating costs and their compliance costs will also drop precipitously. So it will normalize like any other agricultural product.
And if it does normalize like any other agricultural product and it is growing out there in the fields like soybeans, what would its value be? Wow. Well, it's a very interesting world we live in. And Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and working through these incredibly complex issues with us. My goodness, there's still a lot of madness left in the reefer business, I guess. Morgan, thank you so much for joining me. And thank you all out there. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. Thank you, Morgan.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.